lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune.
If you can control about three or four key elements, you can totally own a state. You can make right wrong. You can make truth falsehood, falsehood truth. If you control the media, if you control the Justice Department, if you control the police, you own the system.
And you give me your best.
Obviously, the FBI was protecting something a lot more significant than a bunch of old pedophiles having improper relations with little boys. They were protecting something a lot more significant than a bunch of drug peddlers. They were protecting some very prominent politicians, powerful and wealthy individuals associated with those politicians and the political system, up to and including the highest political people in this entire country.
You're listening to episode 720 of Unwelcome Guests, The Conspiracy of Silence, VI Pedophile, Blackmail, and the Deep State. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard two quotes from John DeCamp, who has done his best to try to expose the Deep State's sexual exploitation and murder of children for its own deep political ends. Now, let me say right at the start, as usual, I have expurgated the language, so there are no FCC language violations. The episode itself was a pretty harrowing one to make. These are very distressing topics, so listener and broadcaster discretion is advised. One of the threads which connects the two videos I'm using in this episode, Embassy Row, is not gone into great detail, but the thought that of all the people one could blackmail, ambassadors of foreign governments are a particularly attractive target. If deep state groups could obtain material compromising those individuals, then this could be an effective tool of foreign policy. As I say, that's not expounded upon in the material. The blackmail element as a whole, in fact, is not emphasized, which is why I thought I would draw attention to it at this early stage. Now we begin with the soundtrack of a film, Spies, Lords and Predators, which was broadcast in Australia in a series called 60 Minutes, and credit goes to xronews.com for assisting in this production, which was broadcast earlier this year, 2015.
Without question, the biggest political scandal Britain has ever faced will be exposed tonight. It involves a secret network of the highest office holders in the land, past and current members of Parliament, cabinet ministers, judges, diplomats, even one of the country's top spies. These men are accused of some of the most sadistic child sexual abuse imaginable on hundreds of victims, some as young as eight. More confronting still are claims that children were killed in order to protect this network of predators, including one boy whose father worked at the Australian High Commission in London. For over 40 years, the evil child predators acted with complete impunity, hiding behind the facade of respectability. But no longer.
They were children, often the most vulnerable, placed in the care of the state only to be betrayed, systematically trafficked to the most powerful men in the land.
How many times were you raped?
Wow. Maybe twice, three times a week.
Boys and girls both farmed out to pedophiles like throwaway toys.
There would be a group of girls and a group of men, and the men would basically single out the girls.
Tonight, three victims speak out. Claims of a monumental cover-up. That children were murdered. One of them, the 15-year-old son of the Australian High Commissioner's chauffeur.
I just said to him that I think he's been taken by someone high up.
And what did that senior policeman say to you?
He said to me, you keep saying things like that, you could get hurt.
And the secret paedophile brotherhood, who to this day demand their right to have sex with children. What constitutes consent?
The willing involvement of a child. It's really quite simple.
A sex scandal at the very highest levels of the British establishment. Child sexual abuse victims come forward to point the finger at very powerful men. Serving members of the British Parliament, cabinet ministers, lords, spies, even senior police, incriminated in a VIP paedophile ring for the privileged and powerful.
It happened to me, it happened to others, and why would it go on for so long? Why didn't somebody just step in and say, we need to investigate this?
Richard Kerr is now 54 and a clearly damaged man. His life began to fall apart when at the age of 9 he was sent to the now infamous Kincora Boys' Home in Northern Ireland, run by men who would later be convicted of the frequent rape of children in their care.
How soon did the abuse start when you were sent there?
A week later, maybe.
Within a few years, Richard and other boys from the home were being trafficked around the country.
You were brought across essentially to be playthings for paedophiles in England.
Boy toys. I felt afraid to say no. As long as I perform well, they said they'd take care of me.
So when you first came to London, Richard, what was the first place you were brought to?
The first place? I was taken to Dolphin Square.
Today, Richard Kerr is bringing us back to the place where he was taken to meet the men who ruled the country. An upmarket apartment complex called Dolphin Square, just minutes from the Houses of Parliament.
What happened in here, Richard?
What happened in here? I was taken in here. I was told to sit down on the bed. And he started to take my clothes off.
It still hurts, doesn't it?
Of course it hurts. I've never forget. It hurts.
Richard was brought here to have sex with politicians and other high-ranking members of the British establishment, including members of the House of Lords.
Are any of them still in the Parliament?
Yeah. Older, very old, lords.
Richard was one of dozens of boys and girls, almost all from state institutions, brought to the homes of the rich and powerful to be forced into sex with adults.
My soul at the time was being destroyed. And they took away everything I had.
British police are now investigating compelling evidence that dozens of children suffered similar fates.
Spiker. I'm age 11.
The happy smile hides a terrible secret. When this video was taken of 11-year-old Esther Baker, she had already been sexually abused for years.
At the age of six, a family member took you to other pedophiles, didn't they?
Yes. There would be a group of girls and a group of men, and the men would basically single out the girls, pick who they wanted, and then we'd be abused.
Raped?
Yeah. They did anything from molestation, which is touching and oral sex to full penetrative sex.
Esther, now 32, has identified two British politicians who were among her abusers in the early 1990s.
The man I'm going to show you the photograph of is a lord, a very senior politician. Have a look at this photograph and tell me if you recognise this person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're absolutely clear that this is the man that sexually abused you?
Yeah.
Over how many years?
Over about 5-6 years.
And him?
Yeah.
So the photograph I'm showing you now is a person who until very recently, in fact the last election, was a fairly senior member of a political party in the House of Commons.
Yeah.
You're saying that that man abused you?
Yeah.
How can you be so sure? A lot of people might be watching this and thinking, well, she was a little girl. Maybe she's confused. Maybe she genuinely believes what she's saying, but she's confused. What do you say to that?
I'd say you don't forget those faces. No way.
They were powerful people. They were also people who very obviously had formed a group and enjoyed having sex with young children.
This man, we'll call Darren, was 15 and in a care home when he met Peter Wrighton, a senior advisor to the government on child development and secretly a member of the Pedophile Information Exchange, a group campaigning to lower the age of consent for child sex. In this home video, Wrighton can be seen grooming teenage boys, encouraging them to drink alcohol and engage in sexually suggestive behaviour. Wrighton would supply boys like Darren to VIPs at Dolphin Square.
We would be basically told who to go and talk to and what to do and with which person.
One of those men, also named by other witnesses we've spoken to, was Leon Britton, the former British Home Secretary. One of the most powerful men in the land, Leon Britton should have been prosecuting pedophiles. Instead, according to Darren and other witnesses, he was one of them.
He liked boys to dress in women's underwear and then to be in a room alone and discover you in women's underwear and punish you for wearing the underwear.
A member of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet?
Yes.
Raping children?
Yes.
Their stories may sound unbelievable, but their accounts of the abuse they suffered are being taken very seriously by British police and by a new generation of political leaders.
I think there has to be an element of cover-up or conspiracy, call it what you want.
Men like Conservative MP Zach Goldsmith.
If it's true, and the evidence suggests that it is,
yeah,
This is, isn't it, the biggest political scandal in British history?
I think that's right. I think there was very compelling evidence that very senior people engaged in terrible acts and were then protected by the establishment. I have no doubt at all about that, but I think the genie is out of the bottle.
Sadly, we'll probably never know just how many innocent children became victims of the paedophile gang operating at the highest reaches of the British establishment. Certainly, we know of dozens, if not hundreds, of state wards who were trafficked from institutions to be used as playthings of the rich and powerful. But others were literally picked out and abducted off the streets of London, including the teenage son of the chauffeur to the Australian High Commissioner. One of the great mysteries is a case now being reinvestigated by British police: the disappearance and almost certainly the murder of a 15-year-old boy named Martin Allen. You smell a cover-up protecting the toffs, don't you?
I smell rats of the highest order.
Kevin Allen is Martin's brother. At the time Martin went missing, their father Tom was personal chauffeur to the Australian High Commissioner.
So this is the car that your dad drove?
Yeah.
With the number plate OZ1?
Yeah, AUS1.
One of the perks of their dad's job was a big house here in posh Kensington, right next to the High Commissioner's own residence.
What a beautiful, idyllic place for a young lad to grow up.
Yeah, this is where we lived.
But that happy life was about to be shattered. It's the 5th of November, 1979. 15-year-old Martin is heading home from school.
A witness tells police he sees Martin being led onto a train by a tall, blonde man in his 30s. He's holding Martin by the scruff of his neck, and the boy is clearly distressed. They only go one stop. They get off here at Earl's Court. And as they're heading out through the station, the man is overheard to say to Martin, "Don't try to run." The only problem is that witness only comes forward weeks later when he sees the boy's face on the TV news. And of course, by that time, it's too late. The trail's cold, and young Martin is never seen again. In the 36 years since your brother disappeared, has there ever been any leads, any information?
No.
Has his body ever been found?
No. No, it's lucky he was abducted by aliens.
The police investigation into Martin's disappearance was at best inept. One conversation with the officer in charge has stuck with Kevin.
I just said to him that I think he's been taken by someone high up in, I don't know, establishment, whether it's a businessman or an official of some sort.
And what did that senior policeman say to you?
He said to me, "You keep saying things like that, you could get hurt."
That sounds like a threat.
Well, I was like, almost fell off my chair at 17. But my mum and my dad and me, that was it. It was over with the police.
Now, police have reopened the case, also acknowledging they have credible evidence of murders committed by the Westminster paedophile ring.
These are children. These were children at the time, and they were abused because they were children, because you could get away with it.
Former policemen too, like Kelvin Ashby, are now revealing the extent of the cover-up. How their own investigations of politicians and government officials were stopped in their tracks on orders from above.
My immediate boss told me that the decision had been made higher up the chain.
Ashby was a detective inspector when he began investigating allegations that a prominent Labor MP, Greville Jenner, now a Lord, was sexually abusing a 12-year-old boy taken from a local children's home. Did you want to arrest Jenna?
Yes, definitely.
Were you stopped from arresting Jenna?
Yes.
What was it about the boy's story that made you think it was credible?
Well, basically, he said that he'd been collected from the children's home many, many times.
By Jenna?
By Jenna, in his car. And that was... We backed that up.
Lord Jenner, who has denied all the allegations, has not yet been charged. But the Crown Prosecution Service has admitted it had enough evidence to prosecute Jenner all along for the sexual abuse of at least 9 children. But it may be too late. The very busy Baron Jenner of Braunstone now claims to be suffering from dementia. And yet he's voted in the House of Lords on 203 occasions since he was diagnosed.
Yeah, and again, it's dual standards, isn't it?
So if he's good enough to vote, he's good enough to stand trial?
Yeah, it still sticks in the craw.
I was about to say, it still matters to you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
What's been going through your head?
What might have been, basically, for these kids' sake.
Have you ever met this man?
We asked Richard Kerr to identify his abusers from photographs.
What about this man?
Yes.
Okay, he's a former member of Parliament.
Yeah, I know. I mean, everybody, yes. Manchester. Cyril Smith? Or Smithy?
Cyril Smith was a prominent member of Parliament whose sexual abuse of children over a period of decades was so rampant that the Crown Prosecution Service has now formally admitted it was negligent in failing to prosecute him. Richard Kerr knew him intimately.
He's got a scar down there.
Did he rape you?
He didn't rape, we just had oral sex. He oral sexed me.
He was a notorious pedophile, wasn't he?
He was a hateful and snake. This man was a snake in the grass.
As we've uncovered tonight, the evil network of pedophiles included some of the most powerful and smartest minds in Britain. For years, they acted without fear of being caught, which was probably because one of their members was the second in charge of Britain's Secret Service. But the origins of their nefarious activities go back to a group called the Pedophile Information Exchange, or PIE, which in the early 1970s openly campaigned for the age of sexual consent to be lowered to 4. Now, be warned, you're about to meet a member of that group who unbelievably continues to say pedophilia is acceptable. Tell us what PIE was all about, the Pedophile Information Exchange.
PIE was an organisation for people who had a sexual attraction to children, and we thought our illegal interest in children ought to be made legal if it concerned relations with young people who were consenting to a relationship, if they were willingly involved.
Tom O'Carroll is a self-confessed, unrepentant pedophile and one of the founding members of the Pedophile Information Exchange. He now shies away from advocating the age of 4. Too easily misunderstood, he says.
The age of 4 came into it insofar as children by that age are normally verbal and can normally say whether they are liking a particular kind of activity or not.
You believe and advocate that it should be okay for an adult to have consenting sexual relations with a child aged 10, so long as it doesn't involve penetrative sex.
Well, the emphasis here is on consenting, the willing, free, uncoerced involvement of the child, yes.
And can I ask you this, though? Do you believe still that the majority of children at the age of 10 can communicate their consent to a sexual act?
Yes, I do, yes. I don't see that that is a problem, communicating their consent.
What constitutes consent?
The willing involvement of a child. It's really quite simple.
But how does one judge that?
That is a matter, as it is with adult consent, for the people involved.
Tom O'Carroll's self-serving views are a chilling insight into the mindset of the paedophiles who achieved positions of great power in British society. O'Carroll and four other members of PI were prosecuted and jailed in 1981, but a sixth member of the group was identified at the time only as Peter Henderson. He escaped prosecution.
Okay, I've got another photograph to show you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know this man?
I know this man.
Who is he?
This Peter Hayme.
Did he have sex with you?
Yes, we had oral, but yes.
The paedophile who called himself Peter Henderson was in fact Sir Peter Telford Hayman, deputy head of the British Secret Service, MI6, one of the most powerful men in Britain. Hayman was caught with diaries full of sadistic sexual fantasies about children. But the spy chief was allowed to walk free.
He's the one who carried the brown book.
What was the brown book?
Like a brown diary. He put notes in it.
What, so he kept notes about what he'd done to you?
Maybe what I say. He had a brown, dark book. He carried it in his pocket.
For decades, powerful men like Hayman were allowed to get away with their crimes. But even today, Tom O'Carroll argues he and other paedophiles should be allowed to have sex with children.
You keep saying, by the way, it's sex with children. It's not sex with children. It's sex, most people think, is sexual intercourse, penis in vagina, and a guy banging away until he gets orgasm. That's not what I mean by sex with children.
What are you talking
and
about?
I don't think we should talk in this sort of emotive fashion about sex with children.
What is a less emotive term?
Erotic contact with children.
And what would that involve?
Well, it might involve touching or masturbation.
In the warped view of the paedophile information exchange, the only harm caused by an adult having sex with a child occurs later, when the child is supposedly made to feel guilty about it.
If they were traumatised, they wouldn't have gone along.
You see, that's another lie that paedophiles spin. They say that the kids aren't traumatised.
Wait a moment.
Believe me, they are traumatised, Tom.
Yes, but many years later, as a result of being told... it matters because they would not have been traumatised, but for being told that they had been abused.
So this is the point. You'd say that it's not the paedophile that's caused the abuse, it's the responsible authorities like the police and
their
parents.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
So you don't accept that having sex with a child can cause any kind of...
Let me tell you, we're getting peculiarly hysterical. Many years later, when people are told that they have been abused and it keeps being rammed into them from the media all the time, then that is the feeling they come to get. They come to think, I must be traumatised because people keep telling me so.
Okay,
That's how it happened.
Can I put to you, there's something in your book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a section in your book where you describe the scenario of a little girl sitting on a man's knee.
Yes.
And you describe approvingly how sexual relations with that little girl can be, quote, negotiated
mm-hmm.
by hints
yeah.
and signals,
mm-hmm.
such as complimenting her on her knickers
yeah.
and
yeah.
testing her response.
Yeah.
And what would be the adequate response from that little girl, Tom?
Enthusiasm.
What would that constitute? How would the little girl show you enthusiasm for you wanting to have sex with her?
Let's move away from...
No. Let's stick to this issue.
Well, all right, let's stick with the issue, but let me address it in my own way.
The little girl's sitting on your knee, and you've just told her, I like your knickers.
Let me address it in my own way.
What does that little girl do to indicate that she's willing to consent to have sex with you, Tom?
How does somebody indicate willingness to have consent to anything?
A little girl cannot possibly be
a consenting partner in that kind of power relationship. She's sitting on your knee, for God's sake.
Yes, she can.
You're an adult.
Yes, she can.
You use the term enthusiasm. What does that little girl do to indicate that she's enthusiastic?
I think that we're going round and round in circles.
No, what is the answer?
We're going round and round in circles. I've given you my answer multiple times, so I'll finish there.
Which is a non-answer. You just can't answer.
Well, you think it's a non-answer. I think it's an answer. All right.
Disgraceful secrets are only now coming to light. Men occupying some of the highest positions in the land, whose depraved crimes have scarred a generation of children. But for the victims of this scandal, for those who have lived their lives in pain, there is no walking away from this fight.
You realise it's going to boil down to the word of a woman 20 years on, remembering what happened to her when she was between the ages of 6 to 11 years old.
Yeah.
They're really going to go your credibility, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm ready for that, because I've been very open about my life and everything that's gone on in my life. There's nothing that... I've got nothing to hide.
I'm lucky to survive, but I survived. Some of the others didn't. I'm the door that opens up everything.
And to those men who abused you, you are their worst nightmare.
Yes.
They're going to be lying in bed at night worried that Richard Kerr's evidence is going to catch up with them.
They're going to get a knock on the door.
And we're going to hear now from Tim Tate, a documentary maker that lives in the southwest of England, and he tells the story of how his documentary on Republican child sexual abuse was made and then closed down, and how the victims ended up dead or doing decades in jail, while many of the US right-wing politicians just carried on in their political careers.
I'm Tim Tate. I'm a documentary filmmaker, investigative journalist and author of books. And I've been doing this for 30-something years for all British television networks and American networks, Al Jazeera, and books for a variety of publishers.
Can you just give us an idea of some of the films you've made that people might recognise, or books?
I worked with Roger Cook for 8 years, both in BBC Radio and then ITV's Cook Report. So this, people might recognise some of those. I've made films for Al Jazeera International, which I think probably has a footprint of about 250 million. So some people have seen those. It's investigative filmmaking. That's what I do. The last thing I made for Jazeera was an 8-part investigative series on 21st century slavery. So we were literally filming all around the world, investigating slavery, genuine slaves, people who are forced to work, get no pay and aren't allowed to leave. And there are 27 million of them in the world today.
Well, I've come to you today to talk about, particularly about this film, Conspiracy of Silence. Tell us what that film was about and how you came to make it.
The film tells the story of the alleged prostitution of young people, teenagers, firstly from America's favourite charity, Boys Town, which some people will remember from the Hollywood movies with Spencer Tracy. Boys Town is a real place in Nebraska. A freelance journalist with whom I'd worked brought me the story, allegations that children from Boys Town were being prostituted by a senior business and political figure in Nebraska, and further that he had prostituted those children, both from Boys Town and from across Nebraska. He'd taken them to be abused by people all over the states, and particularly in Washington, D.C., at what were described as parties with senior political figures.
So what was Boys Town?
Boys Town is it's a town. It's an incorporated town in Nebraska. It was originally set up for homeless, impoverished or endangered children in the 1920s, I think, certainly 20s or early 30s. And it was a caring community. It was set up by the church, by a priest. And it was, its aim was to protect and to nurture and to help children in very difficult circumstances. And it has grown and grown and grown, so that, as I say, it is an incorporated town under American law. I think it has its own stamps now as well. It's a charity, and it has been described, and I believe it is, America's favourite charity. The problem was that in the 80s, this very powerful, influential figure, a man called Lawrence King, wormed his way into Boys Town and allegedly began prostituting children from it.
So what did you discover as part of the documentary? You say connections with Washington, D.C., but was it any specific party, any specific people in the main political parties in the U.S.?
That's going to be a complicated answer. There were two waves of allegations. The first happened in the late 1980s, when young people from Boys Town broke cover and made their allegations. By the time I got to the story, it was 3 or 4 years later, and those complainants had disappeared. I spent an awful long time trying to find them, and they had simply disappeared off the face of the earth. There was a second wave of allegations which had happened about a year previously, but from young people, three young people in particular, from Nebraska, not from Boys Town, but who had been involved with the prostitution of children from Boys Town as well as from the streets in Nebraska. And what they described were child sex parties throughout Nebraska, but primarily in Omaha, and they also described being flown to Washington, D.C. to be abused at parties on what is known as in houses along Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. So we're talking, and they were able to identify these houses to us, a very wealthy bit of real estate. They described politicians being present. In one case, there was an allegation of one of the most senior and famous American politicians of the time being present while a young boy was sexually abused. These three young people made their allegations. They made them first to the police and also to a commission of inquiry from the Nebraska State Senate, state government. What happened to those allegations and what happened to those young people was simply disgraceful.
What was the motive behind it then?
Behind the sexual abuse? What's the motive behind any sexual abuse?
Well, we were talking about this at the very highest political levels, though. So, you know, this does start to look like more like there is some kind of political motive, possibly.
I think you have to be a bit careful with that. What they were primarily describing was the sexual abuse of teenagers within rich and powerful circles in Nebraska. That happened to involve Nebraskan politicians, but local politicians, them being flown to Washington to take part in child sex or teenage sex parties in Washington, D.C. What was the motive? The presumed motive, or rather what they presumed one of the motives was for them being at those parties in Washington, D.C., was that it gave Lawrence King a great deal of leverage. This was almost exclusively within the Republican Party. Lawrence King was a rising star. He was the rising black star in the Republican Party at the time, and in fact sang the national anthem at the Republican National Convention, which is a huge honour for any aspiring politician.
Are there any senior politicians that were named as part of this investigation?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to name them because we didn't name the most senior ones in the film, because to do so, we would have required a great deal more than the evidence we had. But the victims of this abuse, and there was, I think there's little question but that they were abused, gave evidence in secret to a grand jury. Grand jury testimony is secret. And indeed, they also gave it in secret to a secret a state Senate inquiry. I happened to get access to all of those files and read the names that they testified to. Without question, that should have led to a full investigation by the FBI. One of the things I found most disturbing, and my colleagues found most disturbing, is that rather than investigate, what the FBI was very plainly doing was trying to close the whole thing down.
You mentioned that some of the witnesses and the victims disappeared, and you found some other ones. It does sort of imply that there's some threats and attempts to close down the investigation one way or another. Did you notice when you were making the documentary, did you find there was any attempt to intimidate you out of doing it, that sort of thing?
Yeah, without question. We were followed by what we believed and were led to believe was the FBI. Our cars were followed. Now, I think if anyone who knows anything about this knows that if you're being followed professionally, you're not going to know about it. Someone was, I think, quite clearly trying to send us a message that we were not welcome in Nebraska. We were there. I was there for a total of 3 months dealing with this, and it was made very plain that we were under observation. No one ever threatened me, for which I'm very glad. That said, some of the witnesses were absolutely intimidated. Two in particular. From the first wave, there was a young woman, very young woman, early mid-teens, and by the time I tracked her down, and she was one I did track down, three or four years later, she was mid to late teens. It took an awful long time to find her. When I did find her, I literally turned up at her doorstep one evening. She confirmed who she was. She said, yes, she knew what I was talking about, but she was looking around constant. She was very, very plainly frightened and said, would I come back the next day? By the time I got back the next day, the house was empty. I never found her again. From the second wave, there was a young man called Troy Bonner, and if people see the film, they will see him in it. Troy had made allegations and had corroborated the allegations of the two other main complainants. Troy was a troubled young man. He had a serious drug problem, which had not been helped by his involvement in child sex parties. When I found him, he was terrified. He had originally given his evidence. He had then been threatened, so he said, by the FBI to withdraw that evidence and had recanted. So by the time I found him, he was in a pretty tricky state. I wasn't about to take his word for it that he had been threatened by the FBI or pressured by the FBI, but I found an audio recording in these files which were locked up and kept secret. I found an audio recording made by the FBI in which the FBI introduced themselves. It's an audio recording of Troy ringing up one of the other complainants and trying to get her to admit that she had made up the story. She was incredulous and saying, what are you talking about? Why are you doing this? And Troy, in this recorded phone call, was just about losing it, saying, I can't tell you. You just got to say this didn't happen. And at one point she says, is there someone there with you? Are the police there with you? No, no, no. Now, at the very front of the recording, the police, the FBI, had introduced themselves. This is a recording made by the FBI with Troy Bonner. He was terrified, and he said he'd been threatened by the FBI that if he didn't recant, he would go to prison. As a very severe drug addict, he was worried by that. I spent weeks with Troy, and I persuaded him in the end that it would be better if he told the truth. And that once he'd told the truth, there was no mileage in anyone doing anything to him. And he did. He agreed. And he recanted his recantation and told the truth about all of it on film. And my promise to him had been that once you've done that and once the film's broadcast, you'll be safe. The film, as people may know, was never broadcast. Troy disappeared, and a year later he was found dead.
Well, there's echoes there of the recordings made by Liz McKean for Newsnight of the victims of Jimmy Savile. She went back to her boss, I think it's Peter Rippon at Newsnight, the BBC here in Britain, and she was told, well, there's a Jimmy Savile special coming up at Christmas, and I'm afraid we won't be able to broadcast. So, well, how does that affect you as a programme maker when you, after, you know, maybe days, weeks, months even of getting someone to go on camera, you're then told by your bosses and the people that own the transmitters and that kind of thing that, oh, we're never going to show this?
I felt then, and I still feel now, at least partially responsible for Troy's death. You know, Troy's death was, as I understand it, the result of a drug overdose. That in itself is no great surprise. He was, as he made plain, addicted to heroin and crack. He also said that if things went wrong, he would be found dead of a drug overdose and it wouldn't be him. Was it him? Did he accidentally take an overdose? Did he commit suicide, or was it something else? I don't know, but I do know that the reassurance I had given him, and which persuaded him to tell the truth, didn't happen.
So what have you learnt since you made that documentary, and what's happened to some of the victims and some of the perpetrators of abuse in Omaha?
I think it's probably worth rehearsing what happened to the film. The film was... I was then working for Yorkshire Television's documentaries department, and which was the best place in Britain and probably the world to make serious documentaries, to make serious films. Yorkshire Television had done a deal with Discovery, the US and European-based cable company, to make a series of documentaries on its, which would be broadcast on Discovery. And Discovery had leapt at the proposal for our film, Conspiracy of Silence. I can remember the commissioning editor rubbing her hands and saying, it's got everything. It's got politics, it's got paedophilia, it's got everything we want. And they gave us the money to go and make it. And we spent, as I say, I spent 3 months in Nebraska, on and off, and other places, making this film. Everything was shot on 16mm film, which is a phenomenally expensive way of making documentaries. And we brought all the material back to Britain, to Yorkshire, to cut the film. And we assembled a rough cut of the film, which is the normal way of doing things. And that rough cut, my colleague, who was the director and I was the producer, my colleague took that rough cut over to Washington, D.C. to show it, as you would normally do, to Discovery, who were paying for it. In the meantime, my job was to show it to the lawyers and to work with the lawyers to get it into a shape where it was legally okay to transmit it. Yorkshire Television, under its contract with Discovery, had legal responsibility for doing that. It was our responsibility to get a legal clean bill of health for the film so it could be broadcast. And we had very good lawyers, media lawyers in London, Goodman Derrick, and a very high-powered firm of media lawyers in New York. They went over it, and I showed them the evidence, and both sets of lawyers gave the film a clean bill of health. It was good to go legally. By the time that had happened, Nick, my colleague, the director, had had his meeting with Discovery, who liked the rough cut, but who then, subsequently, turned round and cancelled the film. And I remember, to this day, him ringing me, Nick, my colleague, ringing me in shell-shocked, saying, I've just come out of a meeting, they say they won't broadcast the film. And I asked what the reason was, and this was what he was told, and I quote, We seem to have gotten into an investigative area which is inconsistent with Discovery's mission statement. Now, you read into that whatever you want to read into that. But Discovery was adamant. I mean, the film was actually in the listings, television listings magazines. It was scheduled. They simply pulled out. They refused to discuss it any further. Eventually, the film was handed back to Yorkshire Television. The rights to it were handed back to Yorkshire Television, with Discovery paying all the substantial costs of making it to date, and Yorkshire given the right to do whatever it wanted to do with it, to get it broadcast elsewhere if it wanted to, on the condition that no one ever associated Discovery with the film.
Now, that's interesting, because surely it would have made sense for Yorkshire to get it broadcast in Britain.
Yeah, I thought that. We were, as you might imagine, pretty shell-shocked, but I began trying to find alternative networks to broadcast this. And in fact, I had a couple of approaches from distributors who wanted to fund the remaining work, and it didn't even needed to be finished, it was a rough cut, and to broadcast it or to blow it up to 35mm for a cinema feature documentary. The man who was then running the documentaries department at Yorkshire Television just didn't want to know.
What's your thoughts about what was behind that then? And I wonder if anybody who was from Discovery or from the networks here in Britain, because, I mean, it did touch on some very key and very powerful politicians, didn't it? One would like to think that they're not actually above the law and not above having documentaries made about them, these key political figures.
There are a number of answers to that. The film was exclusively American. It was about a situation, a case, a series of allegations, a scandal in the United States. There was no part of the film which touched on Britain. British networks, would they then, would they now have been interested? My guess is probably not. They tend to be quite parochial, and they're not really interested in films which don't have a British angle. This didn't. This was specifically an American film. And in the rest of the United States, I can't think of a single US network, be it cable, be it mainstream television, which would go near this. They don't want to do investigative journalism.
But why not? I mean, I'm a bit annoyed because you've done all your work. You found out that it's legally okay to show. At least, you know, that's what the lawyers are indicating. So how does it work that, you know, powerful people get programs like this as it seems shut down?
That's a very good question. And if I knew the answer to that, possibly I wouldn't be making films, but I would be a politician. I simply don't know the answer. What I can tell you is that Lawrence King, the central figure in this, the man about whom most of the allegations were made and on whom they centred, went to prison for 15 years for fraud. He was unquestionably a fraudster, amongst other things. But if you contrast that with what happened to one of the victims, a young woman called Alicia Owens. She'd been in the second wave. By the time I arrived, Alicia had been hung out to dry by the courts in Nebraska. She had been required in court testimony to name her abusers. She had done so. And she was thereafter prosecuted for perjury. And she was given a sentence of between 9 and 27 years in prison for naming her abuser. Firstly, that's a tell to me. That's an enormous sentence for perjury. But what was even more worrying was she was tried in Nebraska state court in Nebraska, and under Nebraska state law, specifically provided not just protection for naming your alleged abuser, but actually made it a legal requirement. So Alicia was jailed for this huge sentence under a law which didn't exist.
We've had recently the Jimmy Savile scandal, which actually in some ways many people think may never have seen the light of day if it hadn't been for some dogged attempts to get that story out. And I just wonder if you think the child sexual abuse inquiry that's currently going on, at least there's an attempt to get this child sexual abuse inquiry done by the Home Office, whether you think that we're ever going to get to the bottom of that when we don't have these this backstop of the investigative documentaries. Can we really rely on statutory bodies like the Home Office, the courts, to get to the bottom of what really went on?
No, is the simple answer. For my sins or otherwise, I have spent 25 years making films and writing books about what adults do to children, primarily child sexual abuse, and the loose, disorganised networks of paedophiles. And there are men who have been to prison because of the work that I was funded to do. But I've worked with a number of police units and departments over the years. All of them have told and continue to tell exactly the same story. We are not given enough resources to do this job. We don't have the manpower. We don't have the trained officers. And the decision not to give them that is a political decision with a small p. Someone has said this is not sufficiently a priority. Two small examples. I made a film and wrote a book with a man called Ray Wire, who was then the best expert at dealing with men who abused children. And it was about what was then Britain's worst child sex serial killer, who's serving a succession of life sentences now. He should have been picked up long before he was. No one had bothered communicating to anybody else his records. But most worryingly, when I went to what was then called the National Criminal Intelligence Service, which has now been superseded by the National Crime Agency, Britain's FBI, effectively, 2 years after he was sentenced, his name was not on their database. And there was a reason for that. And the reason for that was that they had been given, assigned, NCIS had been assigned 1.5 officers to work on child sexual abuse, paedophile intelligence, whilst in the next office there were 11 officers doing exactly the same job for football hooliganism. Somebody has said football hooliganism is a priority, child sexual abuse isn't. All right, that's 15, 20 years ago. Has it changed? No, it hasn't. I wrote a story for one of the Nationals earlier on this year about a man who had been arrested in Lancashire. The National Crime Agency had been tipped off by the Russian Interior Ministry that this man was trading child pornography via a Russian-based peer-to-peer network. It was a fantastic piece of cooperation from the Russian Interior Ministry. The National Crime Agency farmed this investigation out to Lancashire Police, where the man lived. They raided him. They couldn't find the film he had been trading, but they found other material, one of which was, according to the police, according to the prosecution in the subsequent trial, and according to the judge in that trial, the first snuff child pornography film that had ever been seized. It was a teenage girl shown being sexually abused, tied up, and suffocated, and then lying dead. Her face and the offender's face were quite visible on this film. That film was seized 16 months before I got involved in the case. It should have been sent by Lancashire Police to the National Crime Agency, who should have checked with their facial recognition software. They are under an international treaty, binding international treaty, to send that material to law enforcement worldwide, particularly to the United States, which has the best facial